Hello and welcome to Ops and Hops, the podcast for those who like beer but have to work in tech to afford it. Today I've got Josh Grant, Solutions Architect at SMS Data Products Group, a major firm that works with heavy hitters such as the U.S. government, Cisco, and more. Welcome to the show, Josh.
Hi, Derek. Thank you, man. Excited to be here.
Yep. And what are you drinking today?
All right. So today I've got actually my favorite beer from a local brewery here in Windsor, California. So Double IPA, the Brother Maker, really good beer.
So that was a little bit of a trick question since obviously I knew it beforehand, thanks to the fact that you sent me the same.
So I had to, man. I love that beer. Yeah. Like I said, it's my favorite. I wanted you to try it.
Man, I mean, if any guest or really anyone in the world wants to send me beer, I will happily receive it. So yeah, nice. I really appreciate that. I'm really excited to dive in. As many people know, I am a pretty big IPA guy. Let's see how it hits. Oh, that's fantastic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's really good. They're right down the road from me. They actually just opened up a self-pour tap room, which I've never heard of before. Mm-hmm. Have you got those in your neck of the woods?
We do, but I would have to stay away from a self-pour that dumps this beer, I think.
Yeah.
I don't think I'd leave the spout.
I think me 20 years ago, I'd have to stay away from there. But at this point, man, I like going there. You can pour an ounce of this, an ounce of that, kind of try some different beers. It's a nice place. Yeah.
No, that's good. Yeah, we've got a few of the self-pours. They aren't as common. You know, obviously COVID kind of cut a lot of that type of stuff. But we do have one really big one that gets a lot of guest taps and stuff like that. It's around a lot of our breweries. A lot of people don't know. Chicago does have a pretty good brewery scene, but unfortunately, most of it is hazy type stuff from the East Coast. And we don't get nearly as many West Coast as I would like. And of course, you living in one of my favorite places for beer, thanks to Russian River. And do you have a few others that we may not know about other than Russian River?
Yeah, so I'm not sure how big the distribution networks are, but Hen House is really big around here. I'm sure they distribute across the U.S. We're obviously drinking the one from Barrel Brothers. I was at Fog Belt yesterday meeting some friends. That's a nice local brewery. You mentioned Russian River. That's a mile that way, so that's a great place. They just built a new facility a couple years ago. You can do a nice tour there. They'll bring you all through the brewery. Yeah, man, I'm lucky. And honestly, I didn't know that your neck of the woods has such a great brewery scene until listening to your podcast. I had no idea it was that big out there.
Yeah, we've got two or three different neighborhoods that just absolutely kill it on beer. But, you know, again, as I said, unfortunately, a lot of hazies, but I do really enjoy a lot of Revolution, Half Acre, two of our larger ones that you might find somewhere. But there's a lot of stuff going on here. I mean, when it gets this cold, there's not really much else to do.
Yeah. I'm noticing a shift out here, right? I would say a few years ago, when you go to one of these breweries, they got the big menu back there behind the bar. Half to three quarters would be IPAs, some various IPA. Yeah. Now that percentage is starting to shrink. So I feel like there's a little bit more of a diversification happening out here, which is good. You know, different people like different things. But for me, I'm kind of sticking with the doubles lately.
Yeah, I know the Pilsner seems to be coming back coming back fiercely lately, but, you know, still going to be an IPA guy.
Where are you at
guy.
On sours?
You know, occasionally, in fact, this glass is a Gose. But I'll do one every now and then, but overall, I really prefer just the super bitterness of something like this. But, you know, again, I think that's from all the Guinness I used to drink and stuff like that. And when I'm living in Boston and all, I think I just kind of got used to that. But there were a few really good sour breweries in Denver that I did kind of get hooked on.
Nice. Yeah, I think I've tried a few lately and I'm interested. So I don't know. With sours, I enjoy them, but I'm not going to regularly get them. It's like a certain time and a certain place where I really want that type of beer. And when I think about it, I guess I like beer that some people find disgusting, you know, like I like double IPAs and I like sours. And I feel like those are very like you like them or you don't type of beers. But
so you're sour curious.
I'm trying new things. Yeah, sour curious.
I love it. So anyway, Josh, tell me a little bit about what got you to where you are now. I mean, I'm poking around your LinkedIn and, you know, we talked about maybe not mentioning it, but it does say senior. So you probably should be acknowledged for moving up pretty high in an organization that, you know, I'm sure really values high technical acumen. So what got you to where you are? You know, where'd you start? Kind of give me some of the pivots that you may have taken and some things that people might find interesting that may help them get to the same place.
Okay. Yeah. So I'll go way back in time here and like, where did I start with technology in general? And I'll say when I was a kid, somehow I ended up with this book, Teach Yourself C in 21 Days. Do you remember those books? Teach Yourself X in 24 Hours, 21 Days,
Sam's
Publishing.
I had a month of lunches, actually. PowerShell and a month of lunches, ooh, I think, was the first one I did.
That one doesn't sound fun to me, but you get where I'm going. Yeah. So I think I was around 10 years old, and actually a family member had got me this book, Teach Yourself C in 21 Days, and I just became obsessed with it. I was reading that book. There's this company named Borland that I don't think is still around. They had Turbo C++ compiler. I installed that on, you know, the family computer, made it all the way through C to about pointers. That was too much for me at 10 years old and kind of dropped off on that and really stuck with it throughout my life. Got into web development for a while there. I joined the Coast Guard. I actually did 20 years in the Coast Guard as an electronics technician. I would say that's my first real pivotal moment to get where I am now. As an electronics technician, I didn't do things that, you know, directly relate to what I do today, but there's so many small things that prepared me for where I am today. I was an instructor for about 6 years, so I taught electronics and some advanced electronic systems, and just the skills I gained talking to people, taking these complex ideas and translating them in a simple manner that people can understand, that's super valuable in this industry. Ended up about 3 years before I retired from the Coast Guard, I started my own business. I jumped on. Have you heard of AWS IQ?
Yep.
Okay. Yeah. So I kind of decided I was going to go the AWS route. It was a toss up between Salesforce because they have this really nice veterans program, or AWS. I'm very glad I went AWS route. I got onto IQ after I got my solutions architect associate and just started going to work. Ended up forming my own small business, ran that for about 3 years, learned a lot. Learned so much having that hands-on practical knowledge. I think some of my early jobs, you know, I probably worked 50 hours for like $500 or something, but it's the experience that was valuable. From there, through networking, you know, human networking, I ended up meeting some people at SMS Data Products Group. I got into this nice Department of Defense program that allowed me to transition out of the Coast Guard about 6 months earlier than I normally would have retired. Did sort of like an internship with the company, though I came with a significant amount of experience and was able to move that into a full-time position. So pivotal moments, definitely being an instructor, definitely teaching and learning those skills. And that family member who really didn't know it, but they set forth this path for me at a very young age.
Yeah, I can obviously relate pretty closely with the whole instructor idea. Definitely something that I currently do now. And I've met so many great people instructing, and you know, it's great to just see so many people from different walks of life and stuff like that. So you started with C. Did you find in your electronics work that you know, C is obviously used in a lot of much lower level systems, C and C++. Did you find that helped you in that a lot? Did you use it a lot, or was it pretty bifurcated from programming in general?
Yeah, so I'll say what I did in the Coast Guard, I would say that it helped me by understanding that abstraction layer below where I was working, right? So Coast Guard's small. As an electronics technician in the Coast Guard, you do probably 5 different jobs in other branches of the military. So when I say electronics, that also includes working on Unix-based operating systems and these like consoles and you know, for weapon systems. So you get very much into the computers, you get very much into the electronics with radios and radars, and understanding, you know, the logic and the programming, the firmware, what even is firmware, right? How could that be a problem that could cause this issue we're experiencing? So while I didn't directly do any software engineering in the Coast Guard, definitely just universally understanding the abstraction layer below where you work is valuable.
Yeah, for sure. And I know firmware comes up a lot in security conversations, especially thanks to things like Stuxnet. For those mm-hmm. who are not familiar, some people, theoretically, in the United States government decided to, I believe, if I recall correctly, they were able to get the firmware of a printer, I believe, infected. And through that, they were able to spin the centrifuges in a nuclear facility in Iran so fast that they actually destroyed a lot of research. If I remember correctly, that's what it is. So for those of you going into the cybersecurity world, you might want to think about really diving low, because that's where a lot of the biggest damage happens, I'm sure.
Can you imagine the meeting where that idea first came about? Like, they're sitting around a table, and maybe it was a junior engineer, right? Maybe there's a junior engineer that's like, hey guys, I got an idea. Let's infect their printer and then spread that over their internal network to these centrifuges and just make them spin too fast, right? I imagine some people were like, no, it's not going to work.
I've got to imagine that came after they loosened the restrictions on cybersecurity individuals being able to have marijuana in their system and get hired. Because I can't
the creativity.
Imagine yeah. anybody came up with that without a little bit of help.
Yeah, definitely a creative problem solving.
Yeah. And for those who don't know, the FBI, I believe it was, did have to loosen their restrictions because they were unable to hire with like extreme anti-drug measures. They were finding that most people in the security world actually partake. So
I'm not surprised at all. I mean, I live in California. I come with a military background, and the circles I'm in, that's definitely not something I see on the day to day. But just living in California, whenever the few times I do go down to San Francisco, I'm not surprised that it would be hard to hire, significant amount of high talented individuals while drug testing them.
Right. Yeah. So in the electronic stuff you did, it sounds like the programming kind of helped you see the patterns and things, because, programming, electronics, everything's kind of based on similar engineering patterns. Do you find that, did you deal with like a lot of ladder logic and things like that with like programmable logic controllers and things like that? Or were you kind of away from those types of things?
Yeah, it's kind of away from those types of things. So I spent a lot of times on ships based out of the West Coast. We would do counter-narcotic patrols kind of down Central and South America. And on these larger ships, when we have those PLCs, programmable logic controllers, those are usually maintained by what we call electricians' mates. So I was an electronics technician. I mostly worked in this room that we called CIC, or Combat Information Center. So I would work on the electronics that drive our weapon systems, our radars, our radios, ship navigation type things. But typically the PLCs would be more for distributing power across the ships, running our generators, running our main engines and so forth. Yeah, so it's kind of a different rate that did those. But I will say, you speak to generalities, right? Like taking lessons learned from that electronics world and applying them to my current career. I think that's really something that helps you become more senior in your career. Looking at these abstractions, when you take this specific concrete problem and you zoom out and say, okay, what is the logic behind this? What is the core abstraction? What is the common pattern here? And then you can learn from that and you can apply it in other places. So I think having that skill and being able to apply it is very valuable in this industry.
Yeah. I mean, it's all inputs and outputs at the end of the day. So I think that helps a lot. And I hear that same story from a lot of people, that started, they all start with something that may not be specifically tech. And then they find out, you've got people from the people world, we got people who work in retail or customer service or stuff like that. And they learn how to apply so many of those people problems to actual technical problems. And, you find that these people and the empathy they gain turns out to help a lot within their job, even if what they were doing had nothing to do with tech. And I find that hiring managers who overlook those types of skill sets are going to shoot themselves in the foot eventually.
I agree. I'm big into mentoring. Like one of the ways I got to where I am now is, I mentioned before, through human networking. And it was actually meeting someone I think it might have been through your Discord. I'm not 100% on that. But I met Greg Thomas, who works at HashiCorp. He's a senior solutions engineer. We ended up talking. He's former military. He introduced me to Andrew Stanley, that's the director of engineering at SMS Data Products Group. And that's ultimately how I got in the position I'm in now. So one thing that I talk about with people I'm mentoring is how important networking is. And also they come at it with the idea that they don't have experience. You don't have technical experience maybe in this specific field, but you've got a lot of experience from that previous employment. Like you mentioned, the human interaction, the instruction, some other technical field where those generalized concepts apply to this field. So definitely.
Yeah, that's, I was glad to hear that that Discord actually led to something. That's great. Yeah, Greg Thomas, I've talked to him several times. He's seems to be a super great guy. I've never met him in person, but
I
seems
just
to be a
met him
really
in
good guy.
person. Yeah, the first time that I met him in person was at reInvent recently. So that was nice to finally get to, meet face to face after he's really helped me so much.
Oh yeah, for sure. So you said you're still mentoring. When you taught electronics, take me back there again. What was, you said you taught, like, were you teaching with a school, like a college or something like that, or?
Okay. So from my first tour of duty where I was an instructor was from 2014 to 2018, and it was actually right down the road here in Petaluma, California. That's where one of the Coast Guard training centers is. That's where all electronics technicians go for their initial training to become an electronics technician. And we also have advanced schools there. So if you're going to a specific ship that has a specific radar, you would go to this training facility and learn how to, work on that radar. So I started off teaching I think of it as an advanced troubleshooting course, which troubleshooting is one of those generalized things that definitely applies in our current field. But I think of it as an advanced troubleshooting course, but really it was based around this military transceiver, which is a radio, basically. So I would teach the students radio theory. I would teach the students how to half step, which is the concept of input, output. Output's bad. Okay, I can go check in the middle. Oh, that's good. Okay, then my problem's over here. Or hey, that one in the middle was bad. Okay, check in the middle again, right? It's actually a binary search. But I would teach them concepts like that or signal injection. Hey, I'm going to inject a known good signal here. Does it make it out? No. Okay, I'm going to inject it here. Does it make it out? Yes, the problem's this way. So those general concepts. I did that for about 2 years, and then I moved into teaching this advanced radar system. Which was really nice, just seeing what was at the time, one of our newest systems on one of our newest classes of ships. From there, I kind of left, went to another ship, did some other things, and I circled back at the end of my career. So my last 2 years in the Coast Guard, I led the team who instructed all the courses in that kind of like advanced radar part of the school.
That's really, really interesting. So how much foundation did the students have before they came to you to learn about the radar stuff? Were you kind of earlier in their journey, or was this something like these are experienced coming back and learning how to get better?
Yeah, that's part of the problem. With the Coast Guard being so small, you wear so many different hats. So specifically speaking of the radar school, the students who would come there were about to go to a ship that had that radar, but they all came from different types of units. You could have one that came from a very similar ship that has a similar radar, and they're well equipped to excel at this course. And you could have some that were what we call out of rate, meaning they were at a unit doing a job that's different than their core job. So they could have spent 4+ years not even working on electronics. They could have been a recruiter. They could have been a company commander at boot camp, which is like a drill sergeant in other branches. So it varies, and that's part of the challenge of kind of bringing these people, catching them up on where they need to be, and making sure they're going to be successful so their next unit can accomplish their mission.
So how would you think to, and I don't know if you actually divvied people up or what you did, but would you maybe take some of those people that had no idea, a recruiter and mix them in with groups of people possibly that had the experience? Or did you find that sometimes taking all the people with no experience and teaching them differently just as a separate group made more sense? How would you handle that type of disparity?
Yeah, that's a great question. So this particular course, it was at most 8 students at a time, because when I say radar, think of, I'm not sure what size room you're in, but think of the entire wall, just big, electronics box that you can take all apart. So it's very large, to the point where the training center only has one physical radar. So that's a limitation on the number of students we can bring through, because you don't want to just teach them theory and say, yeah, that's what it looks like. You want them to get hands-on the equipment, working on it. So at most, we'd have about 8 students. When we would get, various levels of technical ability in there, typically I would take one of the more senior people who probably doesn't even need the course to be successful. They can read the manual, they can rely on past experience and be successful, and then put them with the more junior member, and just take the more knowledgeable person aside and say, you got this. Let them do it. Guide them. Explain to them what they've, are missing. So typically that's my go-to, but the Coast Guard's such a small organization, you're gonna see those people again, right? You're stationed somewhere, you meet someone a few years later, you're probably gonna be stationed near them again, or you're gonna be stationed with someone that they know very well. And I think because of that, we have a really positive culture in the way we treat each other. And with that being said, if someone was struggling in those courses, me or any one of the instructors we'd stay through lunch, we'd stay late, we'd come in early. We'd make sure people have the resources they need to be successful.
Were there any traits on different students, especially ones that maybe did not have the experience that you would notice that you'd say, you know what, this person's going to have a serious problem? And I mean, I'm not talking about like developmental traits or anything like that, but like, they come into the class and do they ever like exert some sort of behavior where you're just like, that person is going to have a problem retaining this information? Was there ever anything that kind of
Yeah,
got you tipped off?
I'll say the red flags, right? When, training starts, they come in, there's, this kind of introduction, here's who I am, here's the instructors, introduce yourself. And some of the red flags I would see are a little bit of overconfidence, and confidence is great. I feel confident in myself, but sometimes you can be overconfident and you think you know the answer, you think you know what someone's going to say, so you don't pay attention, and then you miss information. So I'd say that's generally a red flag, is when I'm trying to teach someone something, they don't even know what I'm about to teach them, and they're pretending as if they already know it. So definitely a red flag there. But on kind of the flip side of that, so as a supervisor, as someone who's ran technical teams in those environments, I like having a mix of traits. Whenever I view my team, I think I don't want 10 copies of one person, right? Even if it's a really good person, because then I have gaps. I like having the guy that's gonna hear about a problem, he's gonna pull out the manual, he's gonna start reading. And I like to have the guy who's gonna hear about a problem, he's gonna open up that equipment and start looking around, because that team together is better than two of just one of them. So I think there's a lot of value in having a diverse skill set and kind of method of thinking about problems.
Yeah, I think that makes a lot of sense, and it's always good to have somebody who's going to stop somebody before they run that Terraform apply, but then it's sometimes nice to actually get the job done.
Yeah,
'Cause,
I've got a team member right now. He's not the guy that you got to worry about just running a Terraform apply auto approve, right? But he trends that direction, and it's fun. Keeps things interesting.
Sure. So, it sounds like you've got a lot of this that definitely plays into being now a senior engineer, a lot of that type of stuff and dealing with those types of people and seeing them. I'm sure you can spot them from a mile away when they come walking through the door, when whether it's a new employee or a SME or somebody, some sort of liaison with another company, you can probably pick it up pretty quickly and know how to navigate that person's strengths and weaknesses to get the project done.
Oh yeah, there's definitely some value in having a skill set of being able to interact with people in a way that's going to produce the results that you want, right? Like, people are different and people respond to different leadership styles. And if you try to treat everyone the same, if you try to motivate everyone in the same manner, you're not going to have as much success as kind of not necessarily reading the person, but learning about what drives them, what are their goals, how can you help them be more successful. So definitely all of that applies.
Yep. Do you have any specific anecdotes that might kind of clarify? I mean, what you just said was pretty clear, But do you have any anecdotes that might be interesting to somebody who just heard that? And if not, totally understand.
Yeah, I think I'll have to pass on that one, man. I could try to make
All
something up on
good.
the spot. Typically, I'm pretty good at making stuff up on the spot, but I don't know.
Look up one of those LinkedIn stories where, guy rescues a dog on the side of the road, and then all of a sudden the dog is his boss interviewing him. It's like it's an old meme from way back, but that's perfectly fine. But dealing with people now, again, being able to navigate through all of that, I'm sure is a huge strength for you. Do you have people under you right now? Are you responsible for people, or are you just senior, so people come to you, but again, are you a people manager or no?
No. So actually,
Okay.
whenever I left the Coast Guard, I was a senior enlisted person. So as I mentioned, I ran technical teams, and one of my goals was to not be a manager. And it's not that I didn't enjoy it. It's not that I wasn't good at it, but I really wanted to be an individual contributor. I wanted to take my skill set, my knowledge, and try to just go as far as I can, right? I was eyeing some people in the industry like Kelsey Hightower, who they have a lot of influence, but they're not running large teams of people, right? They're very much on that individual contributor path. And you want to double check me because maybe Kelsey Hightower was running teams, but from what I know of him, he's very much like paved his way as an IC and kind of helped everyone out at once. And that's the path I wanted to set.
Generally speaking, these major companies have room for that. And that I think that's a big decision maker for a lot of people. If you want to go into work and have the headroom to be an individual contributor, you have to choose a larger company overall. Otherwise, smaller companies, and I think this can, of course, become a serious problem for them. But staying lean, of course, right now is so important. But still, to give people more money, sometimes you've got to make them a manager. And a lot of people either don't want to be a manager or are terrible at it. I think it's the what Peter principle. Everyone is promoted to their point of like least effectiveness or something like that, or whatever. Basically, you're promoted until all of a sudden you're terrible at your job, because they have nowhere else to go. So if you are the type of person that doesn't want to be management, I imagine that choosing a larger company is probably your best bet overall. If you want to be a principal engineer, a staff engineer, or anything like that, the larger companies are usually going to be better about that. So that's a question I always ask if I'm interviewing, which I'm not now, but if I am interviewing, that's a question I do like to ask.
Yeah, for sure. And right now, my specific role on my team. So SMS Data Products Group is actually a good size company. It's 700 plus individuals based out of the East Coast, been around since I think the mid 70s. But on my team, we're a small commercial team. The primary business for SMS is the United States Department of Defense. So they're very much like a government contract focused company. And they're spinning off this commercial division and really trying to grow that. So I feel very fortunate that I have the resources of a large company, but it almost feels a little startup-ish, right? I get to make a lot of these early choices, and kind of have the flexibility of being in a smaller organization. So my team is about five core members. So I very much write code, a lot. I do a lot of the client interactions from first time meeting the client, understanding their problem set, to doing the engineering work, to doing code reviews on my coworkers, and then all the way out to project closeout. So I feel fortunate that I get to do that. Whereas at too large of a company, too large of a team, you just get to see a piece of it. And I very much like going from start to success.
That's another big one, obviously. And I think 700, that's a pretty solid small to medium. I think that still actually falls under small medium business, but that's when you're talking about Amazon that has like hundreds of thousands of people and stuff like that. But 700 is a pretty solid size, I would say. In my experience in startups, pretty much from 50 to about 100 or 200 is just an absolute shit show. It's just nonstop. Everybody's trying to figure it out. You've got kind of that, oh yeah, you're a great manager of 50 people who is now learning I am not a great manager of 100 people, but they're trying to keep their job. And all of a sudden you've got all this weird, these weird policies that don't make sense flying around, and HR is always a nightmare. Have you dealt with smaller companies as well? I mean, I know obviously you've been in the government, but have you done any startup stuff like that?
So I have not worked for a startup, but in my current role and when I was doing freelance stuff with my own business, I worked with a lot of startups. Sometimes we work with larger companies, several hundred employees that are in like the nuclear power industry, or something that requires them to be in GovCloud. And then sometimes I have a client that is a single technical founder who has developers that are actually contractors that work for him. So I'll roll into these meetings and just kind of hear what kind of problem set they have. And I'll ask about their infrastructure team or their software team. And they'll tell me that they're it. So yeah, I kind of work with the gamut of them, but I've not worked directly as an employee for a startup. I was kind of told to avoid that transitioning out of the military. Just the stories I heard were about the compensation and just equity and how much of a gamble it is. And living in Northern California, I can't take a really low salary with a small percentage chance of it paying off big.
Right. Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, too, I could not imagine coming out of the government agency. And I've worked with government agencies as a contractor. I was a fun story for everybody. I was a role player at the Federal Law Enforcement Training Center for at least a year or two. And basically my job
at FLETC on the East Coast,
Glynn County.
I almost went there. Wow.
That's where I'm from. Yeah. Okay. So my job was to get arrested all day, every day, or, run fake drugs or, hang out in a raid house and have six guys with guns kick the door down, come after me. I actually fell asleep on the fake bed once. had them kick down the door, and the instructor said it was one of the most realistic portrayals he's ever seen.
Did you almost get fired for being a pretend criminal at a training center? Like that'd be funny, man. Falling asleep on the job.
There is a rumor that somebody showed up with actual weed in his pockets on a frisking roll. So, basically everybody has to go through and frisk and do kind of like the arrest simulation. Mm-hmm. So, get on your knees, hands on your head, cross your fingers, all that kind of stuff. And then they'll frisk you. And one guy had actual drugs on him. So they pull it out. They're like, "Oh, we found contraband," handed it to the instructor. Instructor like smells it and is like, "Nope, I didn't give you this." So they had to call the cops and actually come out and arrest the guy, which I don't know how they treat it now, but super interesting. But, government is so just different. The way it's structured, the way, they've got an abbreviation for an acronym for everything. And being able to talk that talk is just huge. And so, I imagine conversations you have, when you talk to somebody in the government, clicks way faster than, somebody just trying to get in. It's probably a kind of a bro code, I guess, as much as I hate to say something like that. It's a little on the nose right now, but still it's kind of something that I think probably a lot of people speak.
There's definitely a subculture to it. It definitely feels like it's a network. As I mentioned earlier, how did I land here? It was through meeting Greg Thomas at HashiCorp. Why did we connect and meet? Because we're veterans. So there definitely is kind of this almost understanding of, someone else did 20 years in the military for the United States government. And you just feel a little bit like you're connected in a way.
Yeah. Yeah. So how about I assume you have to have clearance for what you're doing.
So I do maintain a clearance from leaving my past job and then to, have the opportunity to continue to work for the government in this capacity. But my day-to-day, I work in GovCloud. You don't need a clearance for the work I'm doing there. So I would say I'm not actively using it, but I'm definitely going to hang on to it as long as I can because I know it does, increase my opportunities.
All right. So tell me a little bit. Let's move back to the private sector. And let's talk a little bit about AWS IQ. I know I've got a lot of people who have reached out to me. I personally haven't looked into it, but I've heard really good things. I know a lot of people now, especially with the ridiculous number of layoffs and things like that, are looking for ways to pad that income or just to build projects or just to get things going. What was that process like getting into AWS IQ and, you know, how did it treat you?
Okay, yeah. So to kind of lay the foundation here, AWS IQ is a service from AWS where if you have a associate level or higher certification, you can become an IQ expert. People who need assistance with AWS can post listings like, hey, I need help with my DNS something, or hey, this auto-scaling group's not working, or sometimes it's way more general than that. It's like, my website says that a security certificate's invalid. So they'll post those. And if you are a registered expert, meaning you have a solution or sorry, an associate level or higher certification, and you've gone through a very easy at the time vetting process, then you have this dashboard and you can see all those requests and you can respond to the customers. You can send them a proposal through this tool. They pay you directly from their AWS account. So it shows up on their AWS bill. You can get temporary access to their account via an IAM role straight through AWS IQ. I kind of tell people it's a lot like Upwork, except imagine way better, right? Just higher quality customers and higher quality engineers on the other side of it. And obviously much higher pay. At the time I was doing IQ, I kind of explored Upwork and some other similar platforms. Could not believe the pricing on some of this. I'm coming from IQ with, you know, what you would expect to pay for some AWS work. And then I would look at similar types of jobs on Upwork, and there'd be people bidding like $20 for something that I would bid $2,000 for. Just like insane. So I haven't been on IQ in a while. It was a very great place to gain experience. And they made some changes to the program over time. It used to be US only. They've opened it up to other countries now. I'm not sure how many at this moment. So there is a little bit of increased competition as an expert on that platform, right? There are more experts, which is going to drive the prices down a little bit. They've added links to AWS IQ on most of the AWS documentation pages. So if you're looking at docs on AWS and you scroll all the way to the bottom, there's probably a little thing that says, find an expert. You click on that, it's going to bring you to IQ where you can connect with someone. So I would definitely recommend IQ to people if they have an associate level or higher and they want to gain some experience or they want to make a little extra income. The vetting process is pretty simple. You do a video interview with an AWS employee that's part of the program. You prove your identity. That's about it. It's pretty straightforward.
That's actually, I might actually look into that. That sounds great because I've been
looking into it. When I mentor people, whenever I'm mentoring people and they're actually, all of them are working on getting an associate level certification, I'm telling them as soon as you get this, when you get that exam pass, go register for this program. If anything, you get to see what real customers need help with. You get to see the type of problems that people have. And I even offer, hey, let's get on there together. I'll help you pick out your first paid job, you know, in AWS, and I'll help you make sure it's successful. So I highly recommend it.
That's fantastic. Yeah, I think I'm going to look into that for sure. I've got a few extra hours every now and then. And, you know, again, just staying fresh on this stuff is really helpful. I do need to go and re-up my certification. Not really big on certifications lately, but I'll go and knock that out here one day and maybe cop on that. That sounds really cool. Did AWS have any, like, did they have any real requirements on what you can bid? Like, did they say, all right, look, you got to stay in this window. We don't need people getting out of control and monopolizing this or... Oh, wow.
No, honestly, like, I mean, you definitely, the process is that you send a proposal to the client through, you know, this dashboard. They accept the proposal and it's kind of free form. You can type in their payment terms, half up front, this much, anything like that. Once they agree to the proposal, then you request permissions and you select like which types of permissions I need in your account. They accept the permissions and you have the temporary IAM role to, you know, work in their account. And when you're done with the work, or maybe even before, depending on what you wrote in the proposal, you send a payment request. So the only kind of thing that AWS controls is your payment requests. You can do multiple. They can't add up to more than the agreed upon proposal amount. But I mean, you could probably do a $500,000 transaction in IQ. I've never done one that high, but I'm not aware of any limits.
That's, wow. Yeah. Do you truly feel that someone who comes from nothing and grabs an associate is able to do the work and projects that are proposed there? Are there just such a wide swath of projects that there's going to be stuff they can go and find, or do you find that it's more advanced type stuff?
I would say it's the wide range. I mean, I saw, it's been a while, I saw requests on there that were actually meant for AWS support, where it's clearly like, no one here can help you. You need to contact AWS support. And then I've seen requests where it's like, okay, that's a full-time job for 2 years. But there's enough of a volume of them that I think you would find some of the more entry-level jobs. And the people that I'm mentoring, that I'm recommending to go down this path, I'm not recommending this so they make money. I'm recommending this so they gain experience, and real experience, experience that they can speak to in a job interview, right? They can talk about this problem that they solved for a client, and it's not theoretical. As I mentioned before, like some of the early work I did on there, I would work 50 hours and charge $500, and it was just me learning what I was doing. So there's opportunity.
Yeah, that, I mean, it sounds better than driving an Uber in Chicago, that's for sure. Especially in the winter.
Yeah. So I was going to say, with it being so cold, I can't imagine.
Yeah. No, it's ridiculous. No, that's really cool. So you've had, you know, quite the journey. If you don't mind, you know, give us a few closing remarks about kind of what you're doing right now. I mean, do you have anything that you can speak to that is interesting? You know, even if you take it to a pretty high level, is there anything you can speak to? Or
one of the big projects that I've been working on the last few weeks that I'm excited about is I've got a customer in the nuclear power industry that due to some regulations has to work in AWS GovCloud, and they need to self-host GitHub. So I'm not sure if you're familiar, but there's GitHub Enterprise Server, so you can self-host GitHub, and they kind of present it to you as an AMI, and that's really all you get. So I've built out, or my team and I have built out, some Terraform modules to, you know, deploy GitHub Enterprise Server, make it highly available as much as possible, deploy a backup solution, automate those backups. Of course, the networking requirements around securing who has access to that. So that's been something I've been working on a lot lately, including self-hosted runners. I'm not sure if you've ever set up, you know, self-hosted GitHub Actions runners, but there's some nice Terraform modules out there by Philips Labs that I've been working with and really enjoying seeing how they build things out. And another good project I've been working on recently is a healthcare industry customer that really has done a lot of contract work. And I get to kind of go in there and assess the work that was done, document some workloads, you know, point out some things that maybe could be improved. So I'm kind of really enjoying that. I have this lifelong learning goal. And anytime I get to go in there and help someone solve problems and learn something, I'm pretty happy about it.
Yeah, you mentioned AMI, GitHub runners, things like that. Are you dealing with a lot of containers here, or is everything run on EC2?
Okay, so the GitHub Enterprise Server is on EC2. So basically, Microsoft has an AMI. You know, you get the AMID for the specific region, you deploy it. For the self-hosted runners, those are also running on EC2. There may be a way to actually do it in containers, and I'm actually a fan of ECS. I'm a fan of Kubernetes too, but I think there's reasons to choose one over the other. But there may be a solution where you can actually spin up containers for self-hosted runners. What the Philips module that I consume does is actually use an auto-scaling group of EC2 instances, a Lambda, SQSQ, a couple other serverless things to kind of, when you trigger that GitHub action, it's actually going to hit a webhook, which is received by a Lambda, send that to an SQSQ. Another Lambda is going to pick that up. It's going to check your auto-scaling group. Do you have an EC2 instance running that can talk to the GitHub server, pick up this job? No. Okay. I'm going to spin one up. So it's EC2 right now, but it does scale to zero. I am a big fan of containers. I actually just did the CCAT exam on Monday, and I'm looking forward to continuing to work in Kubernetes. Big fan of GitOps. In fact, when I'm working in Terraform and I see the Helm provider, I always get a little, you know, like concerned on what am I about to dive into.
Yeah, I feel exactly the same every time I see Helm. Yeah, GitLab is mostly, I know they're self-hosted stuff. A lot of it is done through Kubernetes. So that's kind of why I was curious, you know, where does GitHub lie? I know a lot about their enterprise offering, but haven't really dived in. I just know that they've got it. And so, you know, I think a lot of people are disenfranchised by what they learn. And I don't know that they understand how much of this stuff translates into other areas. You know, they're like, oh, I had to learn Jenkins. It's so old. It's like, well, if you can do Jenkins, you can do almost anything else. And I think you know, again, you're deploying new EC2 deployments. And do you ever play with Ansible at all, or have you managed to stay away from that?
So I stay away from more of the like system administrator type thing. I'm not saying that Ansible is only used by system administrators,
Oh,
but more the configuration. I'm not too into that. So not a big Ansible user, though I fully recognize that it has its place.
No, I was just curious, you know, how much legacy stuff, because a lot of people just wonder, is this stuff ever going to be useful? But I think that just understanding how this stuff works will either give you a better frame of mind and reference for the new stuff, or it's going to help you into a company that really needs somebody that actually knows the old stuff. So
Yeah,
one or the other, you're
for
going to
sure.
get a job.
Yeah, and if you have that mindset that we talked about, you know, at the beginning of this conversation on abstracting the general concepts, abstracting the general problem, then you can apply that to other things in the future. So if I did have a big client come on and I had to really deep dive into Jenkins, would I be excited? No, I wouldn't be excited. But would it? Is there value in it for me besides just helping a customer? Yes, there's value in it. I'm going to learn some things and it's going to apply to other things I do in the future. So I think having that mindset and thinking about it like that is very healthy.
That's fantastic. Well, Josh, this has been fantastic. I really appreciate the beer. I'm super excited to actually finish this beer and take a long nap, most likely. It's been a while since I've had a double IPA, so it's starting to
I'm
hit a
glad
little
you like
bit.
it.
Yeah, no, it's great. I would absolutely seek it out if it actually made it out here. It has a lot of similarities to some of the West Coast IPAs that we've got out here, but again, we've got maybe two or three that I actually like out where you are. Of course, they've got a million, so it's
Oh
great.
yeah, that yeah. Like you could throw a rock and probably hit two breweries, so.
Oh yeah. So, you know, out of everything we've talked about, we've covered a lot of really cool stuff. I'm going to be honest, I've got a ton of sound bites that I'm going to be able to pull out for social networking and whatnot. You know, what do you think would be your last words for the podcast to anyone that's listening that wants to get where you are or to even exceed whatever? You know, what would be your advice to anyone that is trying to move up?
Yeah, I guess hard for me to provide general advice because I think it really depends on where you currently are and then how you're going to get where you want to go. But if you're thinking about that, you're ahead of the game. So I guess my advice is if you are planning, if you're looking at this is where I'm at, this is where I want to go, you're doing the right thing. Continue planning, create a roadmap, network, meet people, talk to people. I would not be where I am today if I had not spoken with people, gone out of my way, made those phone calls, made those introductions, hopped onto video calls for sure. So, just be positive, keep working hard, make a plan, and talk to people, and you'll be successful.
All right, well, that is fantastic advice. So I'm going to give a little cheers to everybody. If you want to do the same, I'm going to try to. There we go. Cheers, Josh. Thanks again
All
for
right,
the
cheers.
beer,
Thank
and
you.
thank you so much for joining the show. I will release any information you want to share within the GitHub or GitHub. Wow, talking about GitHub a little bit
I hear you.
within the
Okay.
YouTube description and the podcast stuff. And hopefully this episode will be out soon. So anyway, cheers. Thanks everybody for listening, and I will see you on the next episode.
All right. Thank you, Derek.
All right, I'm gonna go ahead and